everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2018, and you're listening to episode 102, What Cops Can Teach Christians About the Critical Use of Language. On this episode, I'm joined by J. Warner Wallace, who is a featured cold case detective on Dateline, a television news magazine on NBC, and he's a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, an adjunct professor of apologetics at Biola University, and the author of Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, and Forensic Faith. Jim wrote an effective evangelism article for the Christian Research Journal, and our effective evangelism column features articles giving practical advice on how to reach people of other faiths and of no faith at all with the gospel. Jim's article is called What Cops Can Teach Christians About the Critical Use of Language, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. Jim, it's good to have you on.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, one reason why we wanted to have you on the podcast is that the holidays are coming up in a few weeks and people are going to be getting together with non-Christians at office parties or unbelieving family members. And so especially for those of us who are used to being very involved in like our local churches and in Christian community, we kind of get into a groove of talking, you know, with certain Christian lingo. And so why is it important to avoid specifically Christian language when you talk with non-Christians?
Boy, I'll tell you, I see something similar, right? When you get around a lot of law enforcement people or attorneys or whatever specialty we might have. And I've been in those crowds where I can't help, I'll turn to another police officer and we're at a party or something and we start talking and there's like a code language, right? Based on penal codes and call codes. And we talk in this code language to each other. And if you're not careful, before long, you're standing next to someone who has no idea what you're talking about. And I've experienced something similar as 35 years old. Before I ever got interested in Christianity. But I did know just a few Christians at work. I wasn't raised in a Christian environment, but there were a couple of people at work that I knew who were Christians. And when they would talk to me, I swear to you, it seemed like I was missing something. I once in a while, they would use an expression that was pretty foreign to me. And if I'm honest with you, it wasn't just that I didn't recognize the expression as much as it was that I felt like in some ways, they were talking down to me or the language assumed certain things on my part that weren't actually true. And I think if we're not careful, we do this, right? We can talk in language that we totally understand. It's biblical language often. It's language we would hear in a church service. So you hear our pastors talking this way and we end up talking to each other this way. But especially at Christmas where I mean, look, we're going to – I don't know if your family is like mine, but I've got a family where – the majority are not Christians. And so you have us, if you're together for dinner, for example, you want to pray for dinner, but you might be speaking a language even during the prayer that is either off-putting or unintelligible to the people who are with you who have no background, or maybe just to be honest, are even inclined against Christianity. So they already come at it with a bad attitude to begin with, right? And so I think it's important for us to master language or at least know who is the audience that at some point we're going to be talking to that might either be confused or put off by the kind of language we're using.
Well, you have a story that I think it's, you know, not as typical for people to become Christians into their adulthood. And so obviously it sounds like you were in your career and everything and you're around Christians. So what was difficult for you when you were around Christians and you were a non-Christian talking to them?
Well, I will tell you that for a lot of it for me is this, especially as a cop, right? Cops are a tough group anyway, because we're constantly enforcing laws and we're the good guys that you call in when you've got a problem. Allegedly, we're supposed to be anyway. And so it's hard to even convince cops, especially a guy who's an atheist, pretty committed atheist into his 30s, that we even this notion of sin or using language in which it makes it sound as though we are sinners. That could be very off-putting for a lot of people who don't even embrace the notion of sin. If we don't, or they don't understand it, we have to kind of take some time to unwrap that. And especially if you got someone like a stubborn cop who thinks that, well, look, I'm not the bad guy here. Okay, you called me because you got a problem. I'm here to fix it for you. We're the good guys. We put bad guys in jail, but we're not the bad guys. And of course, we don't even understand our own condition unless you walk us through it in a certain way. And so I've learned even working with cops now who are not believers, I really step back and I try to remember in my own head, because that was the stuff, especially anything around sin or needing to be born again, anything that sounded childlike. You know, like cops kind of see themselves as the adults in their room sometimes in certain settings. So to say that we needed to be born again makes an assumption that a lot of cops kind of resist to begin with, but that's not unusual. Look, I've done criminal trials where honestly, I had to make sure that cops didn't talk like cops so that my jury would understand what it is they're saying on the stand. And they might come up and before long, they're slipping into language that is either coded because we use certain codes to say when we're arriving at a scene or departing from a scene, or we just use really formal language that doesn't sound like normal, even English sometimes. And we do that on police reports to make sure we cross certain T's and you know, dot certain I's. But when we get in front of people, we want to talk in a way that they can, you know, throw the ball in a way they can catch it. And so we have to be really careful about the kind of, I've actually had district attorneys who have had to stop uniform patrol officers who are testifying on the stand and have them speak this in English because they just said something that might make sense to their partner, but it doesn't make sense to the jurors. And so we have to kind of walk it back. Well, I think something similar happens to us as Christians, right? Where we can say certain things and we don't even realize how ingrained that idea, that notion is. And that's what was happening with my partners. They would talk about sin, number one, and that would be either off-putting or confusing. They would talk about, you know, rebirth, any kind of expression that had to do with birth or being born again. Unless you kind of, you know, translate that for people, especially if you've got no experience, then you would think, hey, we're in America, but there's a pretty much still at least a shadow of a Christian culture. This should be at least language we would have heard before. Don't assume that because that wasn't true for me. That was not where I was coming from. That language was completely foreign to me. To be born again, for example, makes no sense to somebody unless you have some context for that. And so that's the kind of language that was difficult for me to kind of move past. It sounded like they were almost esoteric and elitist in the kind of language they would use with me as if I'm supposed to understand this, as if I'm stupid if I don't. And that's where I was kind of having problems connecting with Christians on duty.
I would think that's true, especially if people grew up in a non-Christian home and then became a Christian home and gets immersed in kind of the Christian subculture to come back for a holiday party or family gathering and start using those expressions. People look at you like you're weird. And yeah. I can totally relate to what you were saying about the courtroom, because I've only been on a jury once, but it was a couple of years ago for, unfortunately, criminal child abuse. And so, but when they start getting into a groove, the attorneys, you know, you're trying to keep up with what are they talking about? And you know, you're just not really always clear with some of the things that they're saying. So as a non-Christian cop, what were some other expressions of, like, I would say Christian lingo that were particularly troublesome, or you just had no clue what they were talking about?
Yeah, especially a language that we talk about is theologically tinged, you know, like to be justified or to be sanctified. These are expressions, we get it now and we see the difference between these things. But this is an entirely – now look, I've got lots of Christian friends who would say, hey, it's dangerous or it's silly to reject the language of Christianity because it is theologically rich. And like anything else, we want to be immersed in the theology as a Christian. So I'm only suggesting that we do this as a method. At some point, I learned these terms. At some point, these were explained to me. But if you start off by using a term before you explain it, I had a friend who would talk about that process in his own life of sanctification in his own life. And the only word that I had in my language at that time that even sounded like sanctified was sanctimonious. And I thought, you know, it sounded sanctified, if I'm honest with you, sounded a bit arrogant, you know. And I kind of would associate Christians as kind of smug and self-righteous to begin with, because I was so anti-Christian. So to use this kind of language, it sounded like almost like Gnosticism, like I have to understand this hidden knowledge before I am going to be part of this hidden, this elitist group. So those kinds of theologically rich language, and I don't think many of us would say that, but we say simple things that, believe it or not, this is confused. To say to invite Jesus into your heart, that is an expression that I heard a number of times, or something similar to it, from Christians who, even when they would describe their own journey of transformation, they would describe themselves having done this. And as a guy who is, you know, you're in the gym all afternoon, so you get ready for your shift, you go out there with a bunch of these kind of macho guys that are out there doing this job. And the idea that I would somehow have to invite Jesus into my heart in order to do this was not attractive to me. I mean, it just wasn't. And so if it would have been explained to me what that really means in X's and O's, there's going to be someone in your life, I'll bet you, who this kind of language is going to be off-putting. Even though for us, a lot of this makes total sense, right? Even to say that Jesus is the Lord of my life, to somebody on the outside, what does that even mean? The word Lord for me was a problem because I had no context for this. It sounded like, you know, like medieval times, you know, you have lords and serfs, and I'm not sure quite sure why I'd want somebody. Don't I want to be the Lord and you the serf? I mean, why would I want to be the serf and you the Lord? So, I mean, these are things that you, unless you, and I think we are now in a culture that's paying less and less attention, I think, to the terminology. And so we're going to spend some time. So it just means that when you make those first points of contact, or when you're speaking to someone else who already gets it, but you know you're in the presence of somebody who doesn't, I think we're going to have to be a little more. And this is the sad part about it, of course, and reason why we use this language to begin with, is because it helps us to explore deeper context with a fewer words. This term we know means this thing that would take three sentences to explain if I had to explain it. So instead, I just use the term. But at least in the beginning, it would have been helpful if somebody would have taken the three sentence approach rather than just the term approach.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is J. Warner Wallace, and Jim wrote an effective evangelism column article for us. It's called What Cops Can Teach Christians About the Critical Use of Language, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. To read more practical evangelism articles, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. I just mentioned the title of your article, which is What Cops Can Teach Christians About the Critical Use of Language. So are there any similarities between Christian terms and legal, quote-unquote, cop terms?
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh, there are, at least in terms of the actual words. Now, how those exactly are used and how they might be interpreted could be slightly different. But what I love about, and I didn't realize it was, you know, if you go back and you look at all the apologetics books that are out there, you'll see there's a huge number of them that have titles, at least, that somehow try to relate them to trials, to evidence that demands a verdict, the case for Christ. I mean, these are, and there's a reason why this is presented this way, right? And so we see that there is some, if you've got an experience in trial, then you probably are going to be able to help somebody to see what the case is for Christ, what the case is for Christianity, or to understand the notion of crimes that are committed must be punished. And that kind of takes you in a step, right? And so it helps you to talk about forgiveness. It helps you to talk about how someone's penalty could be paid by somebody else. So there's lots of concepts in the legal system that can be used to evangelize people. The question is, are we willing? And we do this. Look, we do this in criminal trials. We never use terms we don't define for people. So the question is, are we ready to start? Let me give you one that has always been difficult, was difficult for me before. I mocked people who said this. And I was one of those guys who would mock Christians. I can't tell you the number of Christians that told me they were Christians on the way to jail. We'd take them to jail for something we watched them do. And sure enough, they would tell us on the way to jail that they were Christians. And I used to think, oh, really? So how's that working for you? It just never really impressed me. But the one thing that people would say to me constantly, and even today, I kind of cringe when I hear it, is this idea that God has told me something. That God told me was God put you on my heart, Jim, or God told me I shouldn't do this, or God told me yes. Okay, look, help me with that because as a non-Christian, that sounds crazy. That sounds like God. So is God speaking to you? I mean, are you hearing his voice? That's the first thing I wanted to know. If God is speaking to you, what? I even wrote an article for Fox News about a year ago on this issue. When Joy Behar said how crazy that was, as seemed to her. And I totally resonated with her response because as an atheist, this was never clear. And I just, and I know that now, of course, as a Christian, what the kind of nuanced richness of that statement, of how it is that God speaks to us as Christians. But if you aren't, if you haven't, you know, researched this or experienced this or even engaged in prayer or engaged in Bible reading or engaged in anything, there's no way this makes any sense to you. I mean, it just doesn't. It makes no sense at all. And so this idea that God spoke to me, I was very suspicious of, really. As a Christian now, I have never heard the audible voice of God. That's just not been my personal experience. I don't deny that happens for people. But I think you can see how maybe somebody who is not a Christian might hear that and say, you know, I don't believe it. I don't get it, or whatever it may be. So I think for one of the things I would want to is to have somebody help parse that out. So when someone says, "Hey, God has put you on my heart," what they really mean is, "Look, I've been thinking about you, and you come to mind either when I'm praying, when I'm reading scripture, when I'm talking to God." There's many ways that God speaks to us through His Word, through the advice of other Christians, and of course, for many of us, it's just the audible voice of God. But I want you to kind of like tell me exactly what that means, because otherwise, I'm just going to end up in a point of suspicion, and I won't listen to anything you're saying anyway.
So, what are some of the benefits of trying to avoid like Christianese? I know like some of our hymns that we love about being washed in the blood of Christ. And that really is speaking to, you know, theological truths. I think as a non-Christian, if you talk to people about that, they might think you mean human sacrifice, or they might not know what you really mean.
Yeah.
So what are some pluses of avoiding, you know, Christian terms that we would immediately know what the other Christian is talking about?
Yeah, and in some ways, I hesitate. I don't think for a second we should abandon speaking in theology. I love hymns, and that's one of my. I love hymns that are either sometimes when they're updated or when they're not. I don't need them updated lyrically though, because I love the theologically rich lyrics of hymns, and I don't think we should abandon that for a second. But I also know that I think the advantage of speaking in that terminology is that we continue to build the theological foundation for each other, and we recognize our Christian culture, we recognize our Christian history, we can track our Christian history through our use of these kinds of words. The same is true as if English speakers in a country. I would never want us to abandon our common language, because it actually becomes the substrate of our culture. I'm happy with that. But if we're going to go, say, to another country and we want to be understood in that country, we're going to have to learn that language. We just got done writing a book about Gen Z with Sean McDowell, and we've talked about how the language for Gen Z is not just verbal language; it's written language. It's visual language, and so I have to learn to speak that visual. Now, what are the advantages? Well, I'm going to increase my reach, and I've got better chance of not saying something that's accidentally off-putting. Because that's my bigger concern. Because I felt that way. I felt like some of the language that was being used in front of me by Christians allowed me to go home and continue to say these people are crazy, because I was misinterpreting it, or I was interpreting it in my own way rather than in the way it was intended. So I think the advantage for number one is just clarity, right? Also, I think the advantage is that it's an act of love when I decide to speak a language that really isn't the one I would want to use. When I stop and talk to my kids in a language that they understand at the age of 8, it's simply my love for my 8-year-old being expressed in the fact that I am willing to translate this concept into language an 8-year-old would understand. So I think there's a couple things. One is clarity, but two is the demonstration that I actually care more about you as the person I'm talking to than I do about me as the person who could very easily hold on to language that's alien to you. So I think it is important for us, and how we do it, I think, is to simply ask ourselves, or try to remember, if you ever have been, that wasn't that hard for me to remember what I was thinking as a 35-year-old. I still remember it today. So that's been helpful. I just go back and say, hey, would that have been helpful to me? No. So I can't say it that way. So I've got to say it in a different way. And I think that's part of what we try to do, is just to go back in your own mind and try to go back to the first time. Now, for those of us who were raised in the church, it's going to be a little harder. And a lot of this comes from, look, there are people you know that are non-Christians, and I just have to always run that in my own head. Okay, that's who I'm speaking to, and I just try to do that all the time. And also, if you know you're using a term that is just, you know, 50 characters or 10 letters, just do your best to at least the first time you use it, to try to do it in three sentences. Because if you have to spread it out like that, if you have to be more articulate and give it to me in three sentences, you're probably going to do some unpacking that'll be helpful for me to understand what you're saying.
So why do you think you were saying that, you know, as a non-Christian, some of these concepts when people are talking to you just made you scratch your head and were really annoying? So why do you think that Christianese is particularly irritating to non-Christians?
Well, okay, look, I think that this, we are now, if for no other reason, it almost sounds like a dog whistle for a lot of us who are non-Christians, that you would use this language, and sometimes you'll use a little, I always thought that Christians were just trying to kind of identify their fellow Christians in their crowd by using coded language that the rest of us won't understand. That was my view as a non-Christian, right? And I think that the culture is set up, we are set up as humans, as fallen humans, to chase autonomy. We all want to be autonomous. We don't want anyone telling us what to do. We want to live our own lives, and especially want moral autonomy. So already I am inclined to reject any worldview that requires me to submit my autonomy. And I know what that worldview is, probably. If in a Christian nation, it's all you Christians who are trying to control me with that book of rules. And so when I hear language that I recognize is from the book of rules, I might turn that off right away, because I don't want to. That's that stuff. Now, you've identified, you can use it as a dog whistle to say certain things. By the way, don't we see this in politics all the time? You get somebody who will stand up there who's running for an office, who probably has never opened a Bible, has no idea what it teaches, but that person, he or she knows that there are certain terms, certain ways of saying things, maybe a piece of a verse or a certain expression that's part of the language of Christianese, that if they just include it in the speech tonight, or they just include it in their press release, it's a dog whistle to all the Christians. Oh, he must be a believer, because they recognize, well, for all the unbelievers, we know what the dog whistles are too. And we're like, really? We're offended by it. So I think that's part of it, right? And I'm talking about people like me who were really anti-theists. We weren't just atheists. I was an anti-theist. I thought that this is all part of your mind control. And even your language is in an effort to control me, because it's trying to exclude me or to dog whistle to all your friends that you're part of the same group. And that's the stuff that, just to be an extreme on it, that's stuff that really irritated me. But just if we get back to the simplest of it is, you know, how effective are you if you're not clear? I mean, imagine if I told you that, if I was telling you about a certain crime scene and I told you that I was 97 at 1750. Well, okay, what did you just say? What I really said in code was 1097, I arrived at 1750, and which is military time for, you know, 550. Just tell me you arrived at 550 if you want me to understand that. But if I use the coded language, I just can't be clear. And that's part of it, right? And I've seen people who also have used that kind of coded language to dog whistle to the other cops that were all part of the same group as well. And that, I think people find that offensive too. So a lot of this is just a matter of us trying to make sure that we love people enough to speak their language, not ours.
I think some Christians might say, are you trying to water down theological truths? Because shouldn't we try to maintain Christian language that God has given us to, you know, communicate the gospel? And by trying to make it quote unquote relevant, we're really watering down the message.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's why I want to be careful about it. I do not suggest that we should abandon the, I think the language does become the theological underpinning for our conversations as we speak to other Christians. And so what I wanted, if you don't want to sacrifice the theological content, and I agree we shouldn't, well, then what we have to do is we have to unwrap it. We have to completely unwrap it for people. And so what it means is every word, if we're going to be washed by the blood of the Lamb, that I'm going to have to help people understand what I mean by washed, why the blood is important, what is that, what role does that play, and who or what is the Lamb. So I can come at this and be as intensely theological as I was by using the expression to be washed by the blood of the Lamb, but now it's coming out in three or four sentences that unpack washed and blood and Lamb. So I can retain the theological importance of this expression. Now, the next time I've done this, now they are familiar with the sentence. Now I can actually use it again. I can use it in the way we would use it with other they're Christians. But yeah, I agree that the danger is that we just not just ignore the sentence, but we also ignore the concepts that are expressed in the sentence. We can't do that. We're going to have to, if we're talking about sanctification, we're going to have to say, okay, well, what I mean by sanctification is this. And so there, and I'm going to unpack what that means. And also, if I'm honest with you, I'm trying to reach young people because I think it's a very important generation. And so I can't sound like Professor Theology who's going to be on a whiteboard writing out theology. I have to not only unpack the expression sanctification, but I have to do it in a way that is engaging enough or uses is familiar enough by either visual, word pictures or metaphors that young people can grasp. So it's a bigger challenge, right? It's not just that I got to stop using language that's confusing, but I've got to figure out, well, what is the linguistic, the rhetorical approach I should take so that these folks not only get the concept of sanctification, but they also go, yeah, I want to know more about that, you know? So it is a challenge for sure, but none of us will master that challenge if we just don't even begin to embrace it. We have to embrace the challenge and try at least to make the effort to decode our language. I think we kind of all get that, but boy, if you were to transcribe and have someone transcribe your last conversation, say in the parking lot on the way home from church, where you just met somebody else in the parking lot and you're talking about the sermon, I bet you would find that there is language still that would not be understandable to people who are on the outside looking in. And that's the kind of stuff we have to work on.
Well, I'd like to have you leave with some tips, especially as we head home for the holidays with, you know, encountering some relatives that were your 35-year-old self, you know, pretty hostile, anti-theists. First of all, what are some good tips to think about when trying to avoid this form of Christian jargon as we talk to our family members and other friends? And then secondly, what are some ways we can engage them if someone really is kind of defensive about Christianity?
Yeah, two things I think will help. Number one, asking questions that unpack. So you're not always making proclamations, but instead you're just unpacking where people stand. Now, a lot of times at family holidays, these kinds of conversations may not even come up. And then the question is, well, do I want to initiate this conversation? I would say, yes, I want to initiate it, but you got to come at it in a way where you ask good questions about people and where they are, know where your people are. But here's the one tip that I would say would help conversations more than anything else. And that is, I've just started to kind of do this as a matter of course. I tell this to pastors who are preaching on Sunday. I tell this to youth workers who are working with Gen Z. I tell this to parents who are raising up the next generation. If all we did was try to provide two whys for every what, we would, I think, be able to stop using the language that we're using. And so in the past where I might say a what and use a language, use a word like sanctification, okay, we might make a proclamation about what is theologically true or what is true about God or what is true about Jesus. And we end up using a language, a word that maybe is confusing. We use words like sin. Okay, great. What I want to do is two whys for that what. If I'm going to use that word sin, first why is going to be, why am I using that word? Why do I believe that? What do I mean by it? Why do I believe it? That's the first why. I want to unpack why it is demonstrably true that we are all sinful people. What does that word mean? There's the what. And two, do you have some reason to believe that's true outside of your holy book? That's going to be helpful for me. The second why, two whys for every what, is why should that matter to me? Okay, great. I know what you believe now, and I know why you think this is true, but why should I care again? I need to know why I should care. So what I've tried to do now in all my conversations is not just do what's. Here's what I believe. Here's what is true. But to unpack it enough so I give two whys for every what. Why is it true? Why should it matter to me? And I think especially for young people, that would be helpful. Because if you're going to say that you need to have faith, well, I need to know what you mean by faith. Why do I need to have that? Why is this? Can you give me some reason? Why? And then three, why is that important to me? Or you need to be saved, or you need to be washed by the blood of the Lamb, or make Jesus the Lord of your life, or invite Jesus into your heart, or deal with your sin, or come to repentance, experience a conversion, be born again. These are languages that for the most part are really hard to understand for non-Christians. But if you could just help me not only say, what do you mean by that? But two, why is that true? And three, second why, it's just, why should I care? And if you just did that, I think you'd have, and by the way, I also learned a long time ago, this is not a game of tennis. It's not me hitting the ball over the net and then you get the chance to hit it back to me. And if I make a mistake, I'm done. We sometimes think if I can't convince my family member at Christmas to become a Christian, if they don't drop on their knees and accept Jesus as Lord, I failed. Like I need to hit a home run. Remember, this is a game of baseball. It's not a game of tennis. You're on a big team with lots of other members who play the game with you. And all you have to do is make some contact with the ball because you don't know where your family members are standing on the base path. You don't know. They could be basically never even got on first base. And all your job will be that night is to do something that moves them to first base. Or they could be on second or third, ready to come home. But if you don't score a run, if you don't knock them home, you have not failed. If all you did was advance them ever so slightly, a foot along the base path, you're fine. Use the language that they'll understand, and your goal ought to be just to move them along the base path. That was my journey, right? I mean, I've seen this, and I've got family members who are Mormons, and any Mormon who comes out of Mormonism will tell you that it was a base path kind of thing. 5 years ago, someone said something that moved me 50 feet. Then 2 years ago, somebody said something else. And then last year, this happened to me. And now they're out. Now they're Christians. Well, how did that happen? It took years of people making contact with the ball to move people along the base path. So in your conversations this holiday season, remember to translate for people, two what's for every why. And remember, you're not playing tennis. You're not alone on one side of the net. You're a part of a team. And trust the other people in the life, the other Christians are going to come in contact with your loved ones who will help you bring them home.
Well, that's a really encouraging word as we go back to those family gatherings. So finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Jim.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
So it's almost Christmas. Do you have ham or turkey?
Oh, this is because they're easy questions. I'm a ham guy, not a turkey guy.
It sounds like you're still somewhat involved, but how many years were you professionally full-time a police officer?
About 25, and I still chaplain at my agency, and I still have two open cases I would like to go back and finish. But gosh, when am I going to do that? I don't even know when I'm going to find time to do it.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
I think, I think I'm, if what energizes you, I think I'm learning I'm more of an introvert than I ever thought I was before. So probably more introverted than extroverted.
And we already know that you became a Christian when you were 35, but really quickly, I'm sure people are wondering if you could just wrap up the story quickly. Was there, I know it sounded like a game of baseball for you, but what was kind of some of the final things that led you to Christ?
That's right. Yeah. So my wife was more interested in going to church than I was. And I was happy to go to church as an atheist just to make her happy. But at the first church we attended, the first time we were there, this pastor pitched Jesus in a way that I could catch him. He used common language and he simply said that Jesus was the smartest guy who ever lived. And that he had said so many smart things, in fact, that the moral teachings of Jesus of Nazareth from just a couple of sermons became the foundation for Western civilization. That was his claim. Now, he said a lot of other stuff, too. And he may have used some Christian terms that I didn't understand, but I didn't hear anything other than that. That was enough to get me to go out and buy a Bible. And so I bought the Bible and I started working through it. And about 6 months in, using kind of the skill set I had as a detective, you know, testing for eyewitness reliability, for manuscript evidence, I got to the point where I was like, wow, I think I can trust that what is being said about this Jesus of Nazareth actually happened. And that started to really become a problem for me because that meant I had to accept some things that I would never have accepted before. And from that point, I started to also read what the Bible not just said about Jesus, but what it said about me. And once I trusted it was telling me something true about Jesus, I began to trust it for what it was saying about me. You read 1 Corinthians, you read Romans, you're not going to come out of that alive, right? You're going to come out of that realizing you're in need of a Savior. But I realized at that point there was a Savior waiting because I'd already done that hard work. I already knew that that was true. So then I was stuck and I realized that, the Bible's describing me exactly as I am. All those rich theological, you know, words, I was beginning to understand what they meant. And that the weight of that was eventually convicting for me. And that's how I became a Christian.
Wow. Thank you for your testimony. Well, thanks, Jim, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks for having me. I so appreciate it.
Today's guest is J. Warner Wallace. Jim wrote an effective evangelism column article called What Cops Can Teach Christians About the Critical Use of Language, and it's free online at our website, equip.org. To read more practical evangelism articles, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. And since it's the end of the calendar year and it's December, we would like to invite you to partner with the Christian Research Institute. And your partnership is essential. With your gifts and the gifts of others, we are able to keep the Postmodern Realities podcast free and be able to publish the Christian Research Journal and also reach millions of people with the gospel and sound biblical teaching and help you to defend your faith through our resources On Air with the Bible Answer Man and Hank Unplugged podcast, online and on social media. So thanks for listening and thank you for your support. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraph, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.